Hey everybody, it's Wednesday. We're podcasting a couple of days early because we've got some Wednesday releases. Happy Thanksgiving, one day early. So this is Trevin McGee. I'm here with Eric Boleyn and Trey Hawk, and we're here today to talk about a couple of things. First off, Eric's going to tell us a little bit about Strange Brew, our screening and Boulevard Beer Feast. Then we're going to hit Silver Linings Playbook, the newest movie from David O. Russell. And Life of Pi from some guy named Ang Lee, who I think
he's good.
Yeah, I think he did like one movie before this. Anyway, so Eric, let's talk about Strange Brew, eh?
We talked about it last week, eh? And basically what's happening is you got all these guys who are going to sit in the theater and drink beer and watch this movie from 1983.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. It's at the Alamo Drafthouse, and it's sponsored by Boulevard, and they've graciously allowed us to host the evening. We're going to watch Strange Brew. We're going to have a beer feast with Boulevard's newest seasonal beer. Mm. And we're going to watch Dave Thomas and Rick Moranis' masterpiece, Strange Brew, The Adventures of Bob and Doug McKenzie. And before the film, I will be talking about its similarities to Hamlet.
All right.
I heard, and this may just be a rumor, that there will be a beer, maybe multiple beers, but a beer definitely that is served that night that will never be served anywhere else.
I can neither confirm nor deny that.
Oh,
okay.
No. Yeah, you'll have to be there because when they make a seasonal beer and when they make a special edition beer, when they go away, they go away for a while.
Yeah.
Like the chocolate ale, that's not going to be back for another year now.
That's true.
At least.
Yeah.
So go. It's going to be a blast.
Bring your donuts and back bacon, eh?
It's a small theater, 58 seats. It will sell out. So if you haven't already bought your ticket, do it now. Just joining the Facebook group does not mean you get into the movie.
And I should probably mention that this is Tuesday, November 27th.
Yeah.
So almost a week from, less than a week from when you're hearing this podcast.
All right. So time's running out. Act fast. Act now.
Movies? Do we have movies to talk about?
Let's talk about David O. Russell.
Let's talk just briefly about the director of Silver Linings Playbook before we get into Silver Linings Playbook. David O. Russell,
spanking the money.
Difficult monkey.
Spanking the monkey.
What the fuck is wrong with you?
Spanking the money.
Spanking the monkey. All right.
Three Kings.
Three Kings with George Clooney. Kind of catapulted Clooney into full movie stardom. They actually wrote a book about him working with Clooney because
He's notoriously
a difficult director to work with from what every, you know, report I've ever read.
Flirting with Disaster.
Mm-hmm.
I Heart Huckabees.
Mm-hmm.
The Fighter.
Mm-hmm.
And now this.
And I Heart Huckabees is interesting. That was like his baby project. He really butted heads with Lily Tomlin on that. And there's actually, you can find clips of him and her fighting on the set on YouTube. If you search I Don't Heart Huckabees, you can see some pretty dramatic meltdowns. At one point, he storms into a scene, yells at her. I think he even calls her the C word a bunch of times. And then he goes out one prop door, and you can hear him yelling in the background, and he loops around and comes through a separate prop door and screams at her more. So that's just an indication of what it's like to work with him.
What it was on that movie in that particular instance.
Well, no, because I just said that he really busted Clooney's balls the entire time they were in Three Kings together. He told him directly when they started, I want to tear down the image of you as a movie star and rebuild you from the ground up. And he just kicked his ass that entire movie.
Three Kings is one of my favorite films of all time.
It's a very great movie. Russell, the thing I think that's really his standout trait as a director is that he can do these genre pictures, like he can do a war movie or he can do a sports movie, which is what The Fighter is on the surface, but there's a lot more going on. The Fighter is really a family drama. The Fighter to me is, I loved that movie, even though, like, if you look at the plot trajectory of it as a sports movie, totally predictable.
Right.
But, you know, it's a family drama, and it's also bolstered by two huge performances from Christian Bale and Melissa Leo. That didn't hurt it at all.
I love that you called him O. Russell, as if he was Irish.
I know, I keep doing that. But it works better. Anyway, Russell, I'll go back and edit that, except I'm not gonna. That, to me, is his biggest strength as a director, is that he can do a simple story, but then he can, and maybe it's his scripts, I'm not really sure, especially after this one, we'll get into that in a second. But I like that he can work well within a genre movie and add something more to it or something unique, whether it's a family relationship or whether it's the pieces of Three Kings that make it work as more than just a simple war movie.
So I'm going to use that as my intro to have you start the review of Silver Linings Playbook.
That's what I was going to say.
How does this fit into that?
It doesn't, at least not to me. And I was really disappointed in Silver Linings Playbook. To give just a quick plot synopsis, Bradley Cooper is a guy that has some mental issues. The movie opens with him in a hospital in Baltimore. We don't really know what's happened. We find out as the movie goes on what's gone on that led him there. He's trying to put his life back together. He meets this girl who's equally damaged in a different way, played by Jennifer Lawrence. And this sort of unlikely friendship happens. And if, like I said, if it's a genre movie, it's kind of a romantic comedy in its own way. But the plot points are pretty obvious and pretty telegraphed. And it ends and gets to where it gets to pretty much exactly how you would expect it to. So
all that other stuff that you said about him subverting the other genres, you don't believe he's done that here?
Not here. And I'll say why. Like, I think that the strongest thing this movie has going for it are the performances by Cooper and Lawrence. I think they have a natural chemistry together. I really liked when they were together on screen. Something that didn't really work for me was how, I don't know, maybe it was different with the audience that you saw with a lot of laughs. Big laughs, big like studio or big theater clearing laughs when I saw it. And, you know, I know that some of it was intentional, but some of it's not. Some of it I didn't really think was that funny. And at the end of the day, it's kind of, to me, trivializes mental illness.
Ooh.
In a bit of a way when it's played for jokes, when bipolar, undiagnosed bipolar and sex addiction are kind of played for you know, got laughs, that doesn't always sit very well.
I think
well
that Bradley
me.
Cooper's idea as a human being to try to deal with what he has mm-hmm. and
the power
the
of
goals, yeah, the goals that he set for himself mm-hmm. and all of those type of things. I think that stuff shows a real maturity actually to the way that they're dealing with the mental illness in this film. And then
no,
also
that does, but there are moments that are just genuine like that are played for laughs.
Mm-hmm.
There are meltdowns. There are things. There's sort of a key scene early on that, at least when I saw it, it's when he's upstairs and he's looking for the tape.
Yeah.
That whole scene, like that got
really uncomfortable.
Really uncomfortable for
yeah.
me. Got huge laughs in the theater. Thought
so
it was
so
funny.
you might say that he's subverting the genre a little bit.
I don't think so.
By having multiple readings of the same scene.
Yeah, I guess. I mean, if you look at what they're subverting, it's more of. Again, it's more that they're pulling punches on something that's a genuine illness and something that, like, I don't know, maybe is worth laughing about. But I've not found the maybe not silver lining, but I've not found the
yes.
funny.
Okay,
I've not found the funny side to damaging mental illness.
Okay, so in for me, this movie I think walks a very fine line and almost more skillfully than. Most of Russell's films mm-hmm. have. I thought Spanking the Monkey was kind of something that you could approach as being funny, even though it was really disturbing.
Yeah.
I think that...
And this movie's not disturbing.
No, I think that Flirting with Disaster was more like a broad comedy,
yeah.
and that was maybe too far in that direction. I Heart Huckabee's the same way, even though it had some really interesting philosophical ideas
yeah.
behind it. I think The Fighter can be looked at as both a drama and kind of a camp movie in some ways. And I think that Three Kings had its humor injected absolutely flawlessly into
yeah,
it.
Yeah, yeah.
I think
Three Kings is his best movie.
It still is. It still is.
For
but
sure.
But Silver Linings Playbook, for me, this is a movie that Preston Sturges or Ernst Lubitsch or James L. Brooks makes. For me, this is one of my favorite
wow.
movies of the year. I absolutely adored it. While I watched it, I understood that there were some things that happened, especially in the plot. There were things you saw coming a mile away.
And
but
some
let's
of it's just fucking convenient, too, man. Like, you can't gloss over
this,
how
though.
Convenient that ending is. You can't.
No, I can, and here's why. And here's why.
All right, well, I can do a lot
the
of
the entire ending of the film is set up by the most selfish act by one character in the movie. And this is the character in the film who we have come to sympathize with and relate to the most.
Yeah.
And this character makes a decision that is so mind-blowingly awful, that is so such a bad idea, that it's just when that setup happens, mm-hmm. you can't believe that it's going to go down the way that it should go down to make this movie go down a little bit smoother. And I'm not going to reveal what happens, right. but I'm
too
just
much
saying
vague,
that,
too many.
I know, but there. Okay. So
we won't spoil it. We'll just talk in code.
Yeah. Well, I'm okay. So I guess what I'm trying to say is these kinds of movies are really hard to do.
Yeah.
Broadcast news, As Good As It Gets, you know, okay. Now maybe it doesn't have the suggestive, kind of sophisticated comedy of a Lubitsch film, but I'm just trying to think of directors who manage to make really smart films mm-hmm. that endear us to the characters, and when the characters are reacting to each other, we feel like it's genuine and not some sort of.
I didn't believe.
So let me ask a question.
I didn't believe anything in the movie. I mean, like I love the chemistry. Huh. Hang on, you went for 20 minutes. I I really liked the chemistry between Lawrence and Cooper. I thought that was the strongest bit. But
hugely surprising.
And yeah. But the further you get from them, the more the characters are caricatures. I mean, the parents, the parents, his friends, his brother, his doctor, like that. They start as real people, and then by the end of the movie, they're like a ragtag band of ne'er do wells that might make it work. And that didn't really work for me. Trey,
oh, no problem.
But the build up and what they kind of use as sort of the conflict or the I guess the catalyst to kind of push the story forward and give it a resolution is really really thin for me, and so there were all these things that just kept pulling me out of it. I didn't want it to be this like dark, angry, you know, like drag through depression and bipolar and this, and everyone's going to be unhappy, and it's like no good things come from this at all. That's not what I wanted. That's not what I was expecting. But I had a really hard time trying to take this one relationship super seriously and have it anchor the movie, while everything else around it just got thinner and thinner and thinner as it went on. And by the end of it, you know how it's going to go down.
Of course.
Like when they all get to I can't even remember the performance hall, but when they all get there and we're sort of settling into the final act of the movie, or not even that, it's probably the resolution, honestly, at this point, if you were to map it out. But when we settle into that, we know what's going to happen from there on. And it happens exactly
that
way.
No, he even undercuts that moment in a really skillful way as well.
We've been talking about
it. Well, no, I just had a question because I did not see this film. Mm-hmm. And I really appreciate that you haven't spoiled it yet because it was really excited. I'm really excited about the film. I'm still really excited about seeing the film. But, Eric, you brought up As Good As It Gets. And As Good As It Gets, I think, is a genuinely troubled film.
Yeah.
It's a problem film. And the people who fall on the side of the positive for As Good As It Gets see the use of OCD and all of these different character types as kind of almost allegorical for the problems that one faces in a relationship.
Yeah.
And those are the people who love As Good As It Gets. Then there are a whole group of people who fall on the negative side of As Good As It Gets because they see the sort of genuine problems that come with mental illness mm-hmm. and with sort of the social pressures on single mothers who's dealing with all of this stuff. And that love just does not solve those problems. And that's basically what happens at the end of As Good As It Gets. I was really upset at the end of As Good As It Gets because I'm like, what? So because they love each other, all of a sudden mental illness and asthma doesn't exist?
It's fixed.
Right. And so and I found that genuinely troubling, whereas a whole bunch of people love As Good As It Gets because they just are like, yeah, but that's what people face in a relationship. And so there's this back and forth with that movie that I find really disturbing. And is it kind of the same thing going on in this film, that if you kind of fall on one side of it, you'll see it as a subversion and this allegory, whereas if you're just looking at the particulars of this film, that you could find it genuinely troubling?
I'll say that it doesn't end, there's not a bow on it the same way that as good as it gets has.
I'd say that's a strength.
And it is. It is. Yeah. Like, you talked about emotional gut punches last week when we were talking about Lincoln. And even though I saw it coming a mile away, like, when the big one hits at the end, I still, like, it still got me just because I like that movie. Movies are manipulation. Anyone who says they're not, just that's what they're for. Where the entire process of going to a movie is you believing that something is something that it's not.
Yeah.
You know, like that there's no lights and that there's no one behind a camera and that it's just a thing.
But did you feel purposefully manipulated in this? Like you were willingly manipulated, or you're manipulated against your will?
I can answer that easily. Mine was willingly.
Willingly.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. I was too. You know, and so that's what I'm trying to say. Like, I can't go full negative on this movie. I just was very, maybe I had higher expectations than I should have, but it underperformed what I wanted it to be. I mean, I'd still come down on the positive side.
So what's the bottom line?
I got to give it, like, I don't do middle of the road. I've got to do, like, a minor rock fist up just because of the strengths of the core relationship between the characters. And, you know, honestly, like, it was nice to have sort of a positive kind of, you know, payoff in it, to a lot of it. That kind of spoiled it, but it felt...
let's just say it. It is set up like a traditional romantic comedy.
Yeah.
It's just that the way it gets there is not what we're used to.
Yeah. Right.
And certainly the dialogue and some of the things that happen, some of the plot instances that you would normally...
Super convenient.
Yeah. No, okay. God damn it. Okay. those moments happen at the same time that they do in other films,
mm-hmm.
but the way that they get there is completely different. Right away, these characters admit things
mm-hmm.
and are talking about things that we don't talk about in movies, things that we don't see in films. We haven't even mentioned Robert De Niro. I feel like we've barely gotten into this film. We're already 17 minutes into the podcast. It's really, really, really hard to make a movie like this these days. And I think it shows his skill, Russell's skill as a writer-director, that he's able to pull out these amazing performances. I'm putting Robert De Niro up there as well. I think that... yes, there's a certain amount of comedic broadness to his part, but I think there's also the kind of underlying depth that we haven't seen from anything he's done in years in this film.
Yeah.
And there's a very surprising subplot undercurrent of a father-son relationship here and some familial rivalry that I thought was really interesting. So I think that because we've been talking about how it manipulates the audience, that we've kind of not talked about all the other great things that it does. I, for one, when I see a movie like this that works and it's working on me and I know that it shouldn't and it is anyway,
mm-hmm.
that means this is a great movie. And I think that coming in the middle of Oscar season and all this heavy stuff that we're seeing, it might not seem as weighty, but I enjoyed this movie more than I enjoyed Lincoln. And I'm going to give it a rock fist way up. Now, I'm excited to see it again and see how those things work on me and see if it holds up.
Right.
But Jennifer Lawrence's performance is
she's great.
So good
she's
in this
great.
Film. And Bradley Cooper, I didn't know he had it in him. And I think De Niro, I think they're all headed for Oscar nominations. And Russell just proved that he can make something special
mm-hmm.
out of the most typical things. He's
he's
one of our greatest directors working right now, I think.
You know, I would say that it is his skill that keeps it from being just completely by the numbers. But that it was still a little too easy to telegraph, or I guess it was a little too telegraphed for me at times. And then by the end of it, some of the mechanism or the plot that he set up, the conflict and everything is so thin that I just can't.
I'm excited to see how mainstream audiences are going to take to this because it is kind of a mainstream film.
Yeah, and what I would say, exactly. And what the last thing I'll say about it is, like, even though I've come down like minor, just kind of positive on it, it has been a movie that I haven't stopped thinking about since I saw it for one reason or another.
Which is more than you can say for No Strings Attached.
Agreed. All right. Well, so there's that. Let's go on to Life of Pi. Ang Lee's new one, based on the book of the same name, shot in 3D.
Yeah.
And Trey, why don't you start us off with that one?
Well, this is about... It's a film that is bookended or punctuated by a guy who's a writer who's looking for a story.
We should mention that both this and Silver Linings Playbook are based on very popular novels.
That's true.
Yes, true. So in the film, it's punctuated by this writer who has lost his story. He doesn't know. And so he's in India at a cafe, and he meets this kind of exuberant gentleman who says, "Oh, you have lost your story. You should go and meet my friend, Pi." Mm-hmm. And so we get this gentleman asking questions to this character, Pi, who mm-hmm. we find out his real name is Piscine de Molitor, because he's named after a swimming pool in France. And that comes along with a whole bunch of problems because his name is Piscine. Mm. And he's in an English-speaking country, and it sounds like they're calling him Pissing.
Pissing.
Right. And so, anyway, he ends up changing, because he's a precocious youngster, he ends up changing his name to Pi. Mm. He's intelligent, and he's exploring, and he's looking for meaning in various religions and philosophies. And it's kind of an exploration of these different religious philosophies mm-hmm. and what they can tell us and how they can change our lives. And it is an exploration through this one character of how science and belief can affect our lives. Is kind of the basic setup mm-hmm. of it. I went into this movie knowing little more about it than the trailer or the poster could tell me. I was not familiar with the book. I haven't read the book. And from those two sources, the trailer and the poster, it looked silly. It looked like a kid's movie. It looked...
Yeah, you weren't excited to see it.
Yeah, it looked uninteresting. And I will say that walking out of it, this is... a significantly more complex, and I feel like in the long run, it's a more complex than a lot of viewers will probably even give it credit for.
Mainly due to that ambiguity.
Due to the ambiguity and what it's trying to tell us. I think people are going to walk out and say, "Oh, well, it was telling me this."
Yeah.
And they're going to come down on one side or the other, an answer. And I don't think this movie is offering an answer. I think it's exploring the complexity.
And I think the reason that you already hinted at this, at the beginning when we learn about Pi's childhood, everything that we see seems like it's right out of a Wes Anderson film. In other words, it is not reality. Mm-hmm. It is some sort of storybook fantasy version of reality.
Yeah.
And that continues as this kid Pi goes on this adventure where he's stranded at sea in a boat with a tiger. And most of the film, it's presented to you as reality because Pi is narrating his own story and he's telling the writer about what happened. But there is something that happens at the end of the film that makes you question everything that happened before that. And when I went back and thought about it, I was thinking to myself, he was telling us all along that this is just storytelling and this is just from one person's perspective. This is not an objective view of what happened to Pi on this insane adventure. This is subjective. It's coming from one character mm-hmm. who has felt like he's learned life lessons and he's now trying to impart those lessons and integrate them into his story. And so I think you're right. I had a really hard time with it that night. I was trying to figure out, well, what's the symbolism? If this means this, what does this mean? And what is the movie trying to tell us about religion versus science? Mm-hmm. And I was having a really hard time with that. And then I just kind of accepted something basic about the film, and it was also during the discussion with you, that both things can be true.
Yeah.
I really like that interpretation of it, and I think that this film is going to inspire a lot of discussion, and because it's a movie and not, I think because Ang Lee, the director, who we haven't even mentioned yet, who's an amazing director, especially visually, is pulling off some things in this film that happen mostly without dialogue, that because it's a movie that's presented in this way, we're able to put a lot more into it and come up with our own interpretation. It's not so spelled out for us. I would argue that some of the back and forth between Pi is an Adult, played by Irfan Khan, and Rafe Spall, the writer. Mm-hmm. Those are certainly the weakest parts of the film.
Yeah.
And maybe less of that might have been better.
Feel like punctuation. It doesn't feel like a vibrant, necessary part of the film. It feels punctuation.
Yeah, it feels like that's the framing device that they chose, and so they have to keep going back to it. And also it feels a little bit like, because this story takes place not in America, that we have to have a white guy for him to talk to.
He is our Raymond Burr.
Right, and so, nice. You're talking about the Godzilla movies.
Yeah.
So, but here's the thing, man. This is not Tree of Life. It's not an art film, even, I wouldn't even say. I think this is also very mainstream filmmaking.
Very popular book.
Yeah, but maybe the allegory, the Christian overtones are a little bit too on the nose, and they're certainly forced down your throat more than they were in Tree of Life, which for me, I'm going to keep going back to with any movie of this ilk, because it's the high point for me.
Sure.
Being a non-religious person, but I was absolutely inspired by this film. I think it's a true cinematic achievement. I'm really, really looking forward to seeing it again. I'm not sure that the 3D was absolutely necessary, but sometimes it was really, really amazing. The cinematography was always great and inspired, the art direction, and I think that this is, more than any other movie I've seen this year, because of its emotional content as well, the kind of movie, going back to this, that Oscar would reward. If this film does box office, this is the best picture of the year.
Huh, yeah.
If it does box office, if it connects with audiences, if this Thanksgiving it remains, you know, if it goes down the tubes like Cloud Atlas did, it's not going anywhere.
Yeah.
But
I would agree, you know, I would agree with that. I think the one difficulty that this film is going to have is the subject matter is a lot more edgy than a family movie.
It's PG. I went and looked later. This movie's PG.
But that's the thing, is there are some very emotionally and psychologically tense moments throughout this, and I don't think it's the type of movie that you could take a 6 or an 8 or a 9-year-old to.
People complain about Bambi. They complain about Finding Nemo. And, you know, the death of major characters and the violence between animals. In this movie, it's not a cartoon. It's not it's not animated. So when these moments happen, and they do, it is very jarring.
Oh, sure. And that's the thing, is even going back to, I mean, the original animated feature, Snow White. Snow White is a terrifying movie.
Oh, God, yeah.
It is a terrifying movie.
The witch stuff, still.
But at the same time.
So good for the MPAA, they're making this PG.
Yeah, I guess. It's just there's some, because it is live action and because a lot of the violence looks genuinely real, and we're seeing, you know.
Despite the fantastical presentation, though.
Despite the fantastical
vibrant colors and everything.
I mean, that there are moments where, and there are moments of real, genuine human loss.
Right.
So there's not even that filtered distance of the cartoon fantasy.
Yeah.
This one, man, there. I would almost advise parents, you know, parents of younger elementary aged kids, almost not to take them.
Oh, I wouldn't. I wouldn't.
I think if
you watch Animal Planet or something like that, I think this is the same type of thing. I think kids need to understand how you know, the cycle of life works and all that stuff.
Sure. Yeah.
I will also say this. I went back and read the ending of the book. After I saw the movie, I've not read the entire book, but I read the last chapter of the book, and the story told at the end of the movie is nothing compared to the graphic detail that they go into it in the book.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Okay. So they're very...
That was crazy.
Yeah, yeah.
So I wouldn't say that Ang Lee has soft-pedaled this at all, but I will say... he put the most responsible version of this that he could on the screen so that all ages could see this. So I actually would not discourage maybe really young viewers. But
right.
Anybody that can handle Bambi or Finding Nemo should be able to handle this as well.
Okay. Yeah. So yeah, if you have that, a not overly sensitive child.
And this is coming from two non-parents.
Right.
So
that's true.
Take it.
How long is the film?
I don't know.
I thought it was like 97 minutes. It's like, you know, it's not. It's
it
like 100,
seem...
right around 100 minutes. It's not super long.
Let me tell you.
It's definitely under 2 hours.
It's over 2 hours.
Oh,
it's 2 hours and 7 minutes.
Wow.
Yeah.
That's very surprising.
Another testament to how good the movie is.
Yeah, that is surprising. The 3D is absolutely not necessary. The frames the frames are very well composed and beautiful to look at, and you do not need the 3D.
Did he shoot this in 3D or upconvert? You know?
No, he shot it in 3D. Okay. I mean, the 3D looks really good.
Yeah.
It's just not necessary.
I would argue that it helps you feel the isolation a little bit more when he's out on the sea. I think there are some scenes that really bring that to life.
Possibly.
But certainly, you know, it's the kind of subtle 3D that we've seen in more responsible movies.
Sure.
And
the only 3D that I've ever seen that I felt was absolutely necessary is in documentary films. Like, I think it's really interesting when documentary films are shot in 3D.
Cave of Forgotten Dreams and stuff.
Like or Pina is another one.
Yeah.
Where the body's moving in space, the 3D then becomes necessary because we cannot, you know, you're not having to translate it to a two-dimensional plane. You can actually have the bodies moving in space in three dimensions. And in Cave of Forgotten Dreams, as they move and track around these structures, you know, these paintings on different cave structures, that adds to the depth and the reality. Those are the only examples that I can think of where I felt like 3D was absolutely necessary. Otherwise, the content, they would have, compressing it into a two-dimensional frame would have been a limitation. And this is not, you know, this is not one of those situations. I really feel like the frames are beautifully composed and would have lived just fine in full two-dimensional plane. But, you know, if you're into 3D, if you like 3D, this is well-crafted 3D.
I would say my recommendation would be go see this movie in the theater and see it in 3D if you can. I haven't seen the 2D version, but if that option's available to you, I would go for it. This is a Rock Fist way up for me as well. The last couple weeks have been some of the best movies of the year, and I'm angry at the film industry for giving all of these great movies to us at the end of the year and not spreading them throughout, but I understand that's how the industry works.
So
I hope everybody's been saving up their money for some awesome movies in the theater.
Yeah. Mine's a solid Rock Fist up. I think this is a very good film. There are a couple of things that kind of bounce or keep me from just going way up. But I do think it's a good film. I do think it's going to be, I think it's going to be misunderstood by a lot of people, even people who like it. Even people who are like, that was great. I just don't think that they're going to, I think there's going to be a lot of discussion, a lot of dispute.
All right. Well, cool. It's good to hear both you guys come down on that. I feel like when you go strong or solid Rock Fist up on something that you were like not excited to see at all, I feel like that's like a normal way up. You were not.
Yeah, no,
you were not excited about it.
I'm ambivalent about giving
way downs or way ups to
anything. So.
Well, we'll end it there. That's good. Two strong endorsements, two strong movies this week. Happy Thanksgiving, everybody. We'll be back next week with some more. And we got to talk about maybe a little Red Dawn, sometime.
Yeah.
I don't know. Anyway, we hope to see you at the Draft House. It's going to be a great time. And buy your tickets soon because it will sell out. Other than that, have a great week, and we'll see you later.
Adios.